Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, and later on Building Bridges, industrial workers of the world, workers versus Starbucks. Starbucks workers form a union.
But first, when Reagan was a liberal, oh yes, in 1948, Ronald Reagan, then the president of the Screen Actors Guild, starred in a radio program sponsored by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, promoting the candidacy of Harry Truman in the presidential elections of that year. You're going to hear Ronald Reagan, the then unabashed liberal, blasting the Republican Congress for its anti-worker policies, including the Taft-Hartley Act, and for promoting policies which decrease the real income of workers while promoting huge profits by the greedy corporations. We will also thereafter hear from Henry Fona, past president of the Fur and Leather Workers Union from 1961 to 1988. He is one of the progressive trade unionists, barring none, and he's going to give us some of his feedback and comment on the speech we are about to hear, Hold Your Hats, by Ronald Reagan.
Garment Workers Union Campaign Committee, David Dubinsky, Chairman, on behalf of Truman and Barclay.
Oh, Mr. Dewey, dear Mr. Dewey.
Yes?
I'm the voter who elects the president.
Oh.
But before I cast my vote, I would like to hear your quote on exactly who and what you represent.
Oh, Mr. Voter. Kind Mr. Voter. I insist I represent the working men.
How's about the NAM?
Well, my backing comes from them.
That's dishonest, Mr. Dewey.
Merely politics, my friend.
This is the story of what the Republican 80th Congress and the National Association of Manufacturers have done to bring on inflation and set back the cause of liberal government in the United States. The second in a series of four coast-to-coast broadcasts presented by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, organized in 1900. Tonight, and at the same time for the next two Thursday nights, you'll hear Ronald Reagan, Melvin Douglas, Tallulah Bankhead, and Pat O'Brien from Hollywood and Broadway. Also, Mayor Humphrey of Minneapolis, Senator Barclay, and President Truman. And later, more of Serenade to a Presidential Candidate by Jack Lawrence and Arnold Stang. But now to Ronald Reagan in Hollywood.
This is Ronald Reagan speaking to you from Hollywood. You know me as a motion picture actor. But tonight, I'm just a citizen. Pretty concerned about the national election next month, and more than a little impatient with those promises the Republicans made before they got control of Congress a couple of years ago. I remember listening to the radio on election night in 1946. Joseph Martin, the Republican Speaker of the House, said very solemnly, and I quote, "We Republicans intend to work for a real increase in income for everybody by encouraging more production and lower prices without impairing wages or working conditions." Unquote. Remember that promise. A real increase in income for everybody. But what actually happened? The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. In other words, profits have gone up four times as much as wages. And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices, which have also bored into their savings. For example, here's an Associated Press dispatch I read the other day about Smith L. Carpenter, a craftsman in Union Springs, New York. Seems that Mr. Carpenter retired some years ago thinking he had enough money saved up so that he could live out his last years without having to worry. But he didn't figure on this Republican inflation, which ate up all his savings, and so he's gone back to work. The reason this is news is Mr. Carpenter is 91 years old. Now, take as a contrast the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which reported a net profit of $210 million after taxes for the first half of 1948. An increase of 70% in 1 year. In other words, high prices have not been caused by higher wages, but by bigger and bigger profits. The Republican promises sounded pretty good in 1946. But what has happened since then, since the 80th Congress took over? Prices have climbed to the highest level in history, although the death of the OPA was supposed to bring prices down through, quote, the natural process of free competition, unquote. Labor has been handcuffed by the vicious Taft-Hartley law. Social Security benefits have been snatched away from almost 1 million workers by the Gearhart bill. Fair employment practices, which had worked so well during wartime, have been abandoned. Veterans' pleas for low-cost homes have been ignored, and many people are still living in made-over chicken coops and garages. Tax reduction bills have been passed to benefit the higher income brackets alone. The average worker saved only $1.73 a week. In the false name of economy, millions of children have been deprived of milk once provided through the federal school lunch program. This was the payoff of the Republicans' promises. And this is why we must have new faces in the Congress of the United States, Democratic faces. This is why we must elect not only President Truman, but also men like Mayor Hubert Humphrey of Minneapolis, the Democratic candidate for senator from Minnesota. Mayor Humphrey of 37 is one of the ablest men in public life. He's running against Joe Ball, who is a member of the Senate Labor Committee, helped write the Taft-Hartley Law. The Republicans don't want to lose Ball, and they're spending a small fortune on his campaign. They've even sent Dewey and Warren out to Minneapolis to speak for him. President Truman knows the value of a man like Hubert Humphrey in the Senate, and he has been in Minneapolis, too, campaigning against Joe Ball. Mayor Humphrey and Ball are the symbols of the political battle going on in America today. While Ball is the banner carrier for Wall Street, Mayor Humphrey is fighting for all the principles advocated by President Truman, for adequate low-cost housing, for civil rights, for prices people can afford to pay, and for a labor movement freed of the Taft-Hartley Law.
Listen next week for the third program in this coast-to-coast series presented by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union Campaign Committee, when you'll hear President Harry S. Truman from Washington and Tallulah Bankhead from New York.
Well, you were listening to a 1948 speech on a radio program that was sponsored by the then International Ladies Garment Workers Union.
Coast to coast.
And that was Ronald Reagan, as head of the Screen Actors Guild. And now we have with us Henry Fona, the past president of the Fur and Leather Workers Union and a labor activist and historian. Henry, what in the world do you make? How are we supposed to understand?
I'm Polack. It occurs to me that what should have happened in 1980 is that we should have had a clip of that speech and followed Reagan around wherever he campaigned and play that speech to him.
There go the Standard Oil campaign contributions.
Wow. You know, the gall, you know, that 1948 was a year after Taft-Hartley was passed. Taft-Hartley was passed in 47 after a year of 46 when there was, not really remembered now, but there were seven general strikes in the United States, and that was the major reason that the NAM and big business decided that it was time that they had to get a bill through like Taft-Hartley. One of the first things that it did was eliminate any possibility of solidarity by eliminating what they called the secondary boycott. Then, of course, what else the Taft-Hartley Law did? Well, of course, they also made it possible to have the so-called right-to-work laws, which meant, of course, that in a number of states you cannot sign a union shop contract, and that's still on the books, and the Taft-Hartley Law is still on the books. So it occurred to me that what we should have done in 1980 is had a truth squad following Reagan around and playing this thing and making him listen to it and swallow it, because everything he did thereafter was in absolute contrast to what he was talking about in that speech.
Not to make Ronald Reagan too much of a saint back then, didn't he cooperate with the Red Scare? And
That's right. That's another great contribution he made to progress in the labor movement. He cooperated with the Red Scare in naming people, but he didn't do it publicly. He did it in private session so that I guess he didn't want to have the reputation of being an informer. But, of course, it's generally known that he did that. That period of red baiting and the Red Scare of that period played a role in the weakening of the labor movement as well, so that not only did you have the passage of Taft-Hartley, but you had the split and the decision of the CIO leadership to expel 11 of the most progressive unions. That really was really the beginning of the downslide of the labor movement. And then, of course, our friend Reagan put the final touches when he really literally destroyed PATCO, the
Air Traffic Controllers
Union, and introduced the notion that was picked up gladly by the employers throughout the country of bringing in replacement workers when people went on strike. You have to realize that before PATCO, no employers really used the technique of replacement workers to replace striking workers. It was after PATCO that big business and the NAM got the notion that this was a pretty goddamn good idea, and so, of course, they began to utilize it, and there hasn't been a major strike since then where employers have not tried to bring in replacement workers. And then, of course, if the replacement workers are in for a certain amount of time, they're able to vote and, in some cases, try to vote to eliminate the union.
Well, getting back to 1980 and the other Reagan, however he transmorphed himself into that other role, it wasn't just the attack on the labor movement. It was a whole redefinition of the role of government.
Absolutely, yes. And there isn't an area in the country, in the political firmament, that he didn't play a really destructive role. You know that as far as he was concerned, the struggle for civil rights, this is the man who spoke in this speech about the need for civil rights, and he literally turned his back on any effort at that time to bring about more equality, to bring about an end to racism and so on. So in that respect, and in respect, and he speaks in the speech about depriving children of milk, and he literally cut the allowances for children in the schools, the federally funded lunch programs. He cut them so that he literally did exactly what he was accusing the Republicans of having done in 1948. And then, of course, his characterization of people on welfare. You remember the disgusting thing that he did about the welfare queens, the people who were on welfare and were making unheard-of amounts of money, and really played this horrible role. Anything that had to do with workers, with the poor people, with blacks, with anything that had to do with the common people of the country, Reagan was on the side of the big business. And it is one of the tragedies of our era that none of this was really remembered when they paid all these tributes to him. Fortunately, there were some people who spoke up, but for the most part, everybody seemed to be bowing and scraping and talking about this great communicator.
Well, historic revisionism is never a pretty thing. It truly isn't. So, Henry Fauna, we'd like to thank you for helping set the record a little bit straighter as to the very backward, anti-worker, anti-class, except for the ruling class perspective of the Reagan administration. And thank you, as always, for joining Building Bridges. And we have been speaking with Henry Fauna, past president of the Fur and Leather Workers Union and currently co-historian of the Labor Arts website. And we're going to hear a little bit of a Public Enemy talking about a son of a Bush. Uh-oh.
China ain't never giving back that goddamn plane. Must got this old nation trained on some kennel racing. Refrain, the same train, full of cocaine, blows the brain. Have you forgotten? I've been through the first term of rotten. The father, the son, and the holy shit, we all in. Don't look at me, I ain't calling for no assassination. I'm just saying, who voted for the your nation? Deja Bush, crushed by the head rush. When I wrote the bomb.
FCC. Well, there are a few negligible words that might offend the FCC's decency pronouncement. But then again, the only real indecency are the policies of the son of a Bush. And you were listening briefly to Public Enemy. Oh, would that we could play it all, because it actually is a very profound, important lyric. But we're going to...
I think they
to
went to Starbucks before the recording session got
is
really
that what you
wired.
Think happened?
Yeah.
Now,
wait a minute,
Ken Nash. What are you doing vamping on Starbucks? I mean, they have dark, rich, strong coffee. They have a kind of humanist persona. And, I mean, I don't get your behavior, Ken.
It's also one of the few places in the city you can go and get into the bathroom without waiting in line for a long time if you really have to go.
Well, I don't want to get get more into that. But in any event, although it does have its functionality.
Yes, it does.
Wait a minute. They don't treat their workers. Well, indeed, they don't. So enough of the levity. And let's find out what Starbucks hasn't been doing with its workers. And welcome Daniel Gross, who is a Starbucks worker, who is also with the International Workers of the World, IU660 Retail Workers Union. Now, all kidding aside, why aren't you unionized? Why aren't you? What did I say?
International Workers of the World.
Well, they are that too, but you're absolutely right. And we'll find out more for those of you who might not know about all the work and all the years of organizing that have gone into Industrial Workers of the World. But Starbucks, you're trying to unionize. What has been the response, and why are you trying to unionize?
Yes.
And we now speak with our brother, Daniel Gross.
We came together at my Starbucks store because we believed baristas deserve better. We work at this extremely...
What did you call yourself?
Oh, well, the
baristas?
Yeah, that's our catchy title. We make the drinks, and we operate the cash registers and clean the store. We're the foundation of a Starbucks coffee shop. We do all the work. And we felt we deserved better. This company had a record year in 2003, took in over $4 billion in sales, and we do a good job, we work hard, but behind the smiles are individuals living in serious, grinding poverty.
How long have you worked for Starbucks?
I've been there over a year.
And you said that Starbucks could do better. Better than what? What are you being paid? How many hours a week? What are your health care concerns? Let's get into some specifics here.
I hope they don't pay you in coffee beans.
Well, I started there.
Remember T.S. Eliot, measure your life out in coffee spoons. Okay.
Well, I started there, as I said, over a year ago. Baristas in New York City start at $7.75 an hour. Elsewhere in the country, baristas can start at $6.50 an hour. After 6 months on the job, I got a very favorable performance evaluation, and I was looking forward to my first raise. They gave me a whopping 11 cents. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I was thinking about telling the boss to shove it back in his pocket. And not only that...
You don't want to get back into public enemy.
Interesting thing, one of the grand boondoggles orchestrated by Chairman Howard Schultz is he degraded all of the barista jobs into part-time positions. So we're not guaranteed any amount of hours per week. So I could work 25 hours one week, 32 the next, and 18 the following week. Unfortunately, the landlord doesn't take IOUs and demands cash at the end of the month. So that's something we're addressing with the union. The other thing which really belies this completely false image of social responsibility at the company is the rampant repetitive strain injuries. They're epidemic at Starbucks coffee shops. The company has shown a truly reckless indifference.
Do you actually have studies like carpal tunnel syndrome and things like that? Do you have studies of the repetitive stress injuries?
Mimi, you're hard-pressed to find a barista, really, that doesn't complain of some mm-hmm. musculoskeletal ailment. And it stems, you know, quite logically from the design of the Starbucks coffee shop. Ergonomic considerations are completely missing from a Starbucks store. And crucially, management refuses to schedule enough people to work to meet the really extraordinary demand that a Starbucks coffee shop meets every day. I mean, there's lines almost out the door several times a day, 7 days a week, at most Starbucks coffee shops. So workers are forced to do this work with very hot beverages, as hot as 160 degrees or greater, at truly unsafe speeds. So, you know, burns are extremely commonplace. I've personally seen some really horrendous, very, very serious burns. Once again, it's the inevitable result of the system that Starbucks has created.
We feel a certain kinship with the IWW, the Wobblies, and it's sort of ironic that this corporation, which people see as sort of the flagship of modern capitalism, Starbucks, symbol of capitalism, should be organized by one of the old radical unions. So why don't you tell us how you got involved?
And do tell us more about the Starbucks campaign. How are you going about the unionization organizational drive?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that my coworkers and myself decided to go with the IWW because we wanted a union that was our own. And we looked to the retail sector and became aware that the mainstream labor movement has had difficulty with their approach making any headway. So we really do believe that it'll take a social movement, a groundbreaking one, and a lot of challenging of paradigms to make this work. So I really would encourage people to get involved. This is a different kind of campaign that we're working on here. So where we're at now is we have a question for Howard Schultz, and that's, why is he trying to obstruct a fair vote?
That would be nice. Who is he?
He's the chairman of Starbucks. He's the one that turned Starbucks into the McDonald's-like entity that it is today.
Howard or Harold Schultz?
Howard.
Howard. So why is Howard Schultz being such an obstructionist?
Well, he's certainly all right in the pocketbook. He took in $17 million last year in compensation. He's quite a wealthy man. But the truth is, Starbucks resembles more towards the continuum of a sweatshop than it really does a decent place to work. They pay all kinds of lip service to a community-friendly image and a place where workers get respect and dignity. I can tell you here today, I think the American people and Starbucks consumers have a right to know it's a lie, it's not true, and it's time that something happens, and that's why we got together and formed this union.
I'm just going to read a sentence or two from this letter from Howard Schultz.
I didn't know you were in communication with Mr. Schultz, Ken.
Well, it was on the Indie Media website.
Uh-huh.
He starts off, "Hello, partners. This is Howard Schultz with a message for all of you. I wanted to take a moment and reach out to you regarding information that the company recently received. A local union in New York demands that some of our partners at the 36th and Madison location in New York City have expressed interest in being represented by them." And it goes on from there. I love it. Hello, partners.
I must admit, there's a ludicrous. Reminds me of Arnold Stang, who was singing in the first half of the show behind Ronald Reagan in 1948. Goodness, is he that out to proverbial lunch?
I wonder.
No puns intended at all.
I wonder if he's read 1984 and liked it. We're certainly not partners in any sense of the word.
So let me ask you, in terms of the recognition of the union by Starbucks, I assume they're not doing it, but what are they telling you?
Well, they've launched into the standard litany of union-busting tactics. They're attempting to pack the unit. They're making promises. They're making threats. They've employed very crass and crude legalistic maneuvers to obstruct a fair vote. I can tell you our legal team, led by Stuart Lichten of Kennedy, Schwartz, and Cure here in the city, is very confident that we will prevail on the merits. We argued the case at the Labor Board.
And what is recently. The nature of the litigation that is commencing?
Well, despite Starbucks's supposed commitment to the free choice of their, quote, partners, end quote, Starbucks has employed what we think is a completely meritless argument trying to rebut what's known as the presumption of the appropriateness of a single-store unit.
So is he saying you have to organize all the Starbucks in the country at the same time, or all the ones in the city, or all the ones in Manhattan, or what is he saying?
They've concocted what we're not sure is a real unit. They're arguing there's a downtown New York City region, which supposedly my store, which is in the heart, as you know, of Midtown Manhattan, it's supposedly a part of that. It's a delaying tactic. It's a tactic to try to seep energy away from our movement here. It has only increased our resolve, and I can assure you my coworkers and I are standing strong. And interestingly, Schultz, in that piece you just read, clearly is trying to isolate this as just a, you know, an aberration in the utopia that is Starbucks employment. That's absolutely untrue. Once again, there is widespread, massive discontent amongst baristas around the country and the world. We've heard from them, and I can assure you that if all goes well, this campaign will spread like wildfire.
So if I go in tomorrow and express solidarity with a barista and call them that, they'll know what I'm talking about.
Yes, they will. They
if
will.
I call him partner, I'm in deep trouble. At least I hope so.
Hello, partner.
How has it been to organize? Because workers in jobs are hard to come by and people are frightened. And what has your experience been as to the receptivity of your sister and brother workers?
My fellow baristas are courageous and inspirational. We may not know all the union lingo, but we certainly know a raw deal. We know what oppression feels like, and I can tell you there's been a day in, day out. It's a very degrading experience to work there, to look at your meager paycheck, less than $800 after taxes a month usually, and go home with whatever it is, a kink in your neck or a pain in your wrist or a debilitating issue with any other joint or muscle in the body, and then on top of it to get a very arbitrary and humiliating written write-ups when you don't dance to Starbucks's tune. And the comprehensive list of solidarity support and things to get plugged in can be found on the homepage at www.iww.org. We also have a phone number for Starbucks workers and supporters of Starbucks workers to call. The number is 917-577-1110, 917-577-1110.
I love it, www.iww.org. It's like a tongue twister.
Well, Daniel Gross, Starbucks worker, and IWWIU 660 Retail Workers Union of the Industrial Workers of the World.
Yay.
Yay, indeed. And thank you for being with us. And we'd like to thank you all for listening, and remember, organize, organize, organize. And if you want to get in touch with Building Bridges, you can contact Mimi, that's M-I-M-I, at buildingbridgesonline.org. That's Mimi at buildingbridgesonline.org. We'd love to hear from you. And
remember to tune in next week to Building Bridges.